sank her in the line. I said, fish, 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 fish. Well, here we are. Another week.
Is that okay? We're ready to go.
We're ready to.
RJ, yes, RJ had to leave, and he's at a, I guess you would call it an artificial human week where they're going to be doing basically androids and how they're affecting on humanity and the newest things. So he called Elon Musk, and Elon sends RJ a nice android synthetic human replacement. That's Joe. He's up here today. He's going to be taking care of the show. We want to stay on the top trends of everything. You know, we work closely with Elon Musk and other people to keep you up on the latest in synthetic human thought. So, anyway, getting back into the fishing part of the program, a lot of stuff going on around the harbor. Fish and Frank here. Joe's actually up in the Golden Chrome Towers of Powers today. So we're going to try and get things going. I think one of the biggest things driving the fishing industry right now is the American Red Snapper. There's a lot of people heading out into the Gulf. And what's surprising me this year is how far out you're having to go. I could be just because of the heat, but we're literally talking 140 to 160 feet of water to find big American reds, the red snappers. Now, red snapper is not what you catch at the pier at Ponce. Those are mangrove snappers. Do they have a red belly? Yes. But are they a red snapper? No. Really, the only snapper we have in Charlotte Harbor or the Intercoastal is the mangrove snapper. Occasionally, we get some lane snappers up here if we have an exceptionally dry season. It's just like we had a big squid hatch come out in the harbor this year because it was exceptionally dry, not overly hot. How the world changed in the last couple. Oh, man, is it hot out. I'm going to tell you, if you're going to go fishing, you want to get out just before daybreak, be in your boat while the light's cracking in the sky, and by 10, 11 o'clock, say, okay, I'm heading back, get the boat unloaded, get cleaned up. By 1, 2 o'clock, you want to be in the house. I mean, that sun is brutal. This is unbelievable what's going on out there. From 2 to 6 o'clock, it's just, I mean, you know, before 2 o'clock, it's not too bad. After 6, it gets a little better. I was on the porch the other night, having a smoke, and it didn't rain by our house. Right now, the weather guys got it easy. 50% chance of rain. Afternoon thunderstorms every day, 50% chance you're going to get rained on. Well, if you get rained on for an hour or two, it drops the temperature 20 or 30 degrees, and all of a sudden it's, you know, 75 degrees there. If it doesn't rain, it's 11 o'clock at night, and it's 85 degrees, and 100% humidity because it's rained everywhere but where you're at. So quite unpleasant right now. And unless you get some rain at night, then it's beautiful. You're outside, you're sitting on the porch, it's wonderful. But in the boat, it can actually be dangerous out here between 2 and 6, 2 and 5. Those hours of the day, the sun gets very intense. I remember doing charters where I would have to literally take the seat cushion from the boat and put it over somebody's head because the sun would just start cooking them. And we've had a couple stories this year already where people have gotten back to the dock only to call the paramedics because people are down from up north. They want to do these 6-8 hour trips on the water, and 5-6 hours in, that heat starts taking over. They're getting dizzy. They're getting nauseous. Call the paramedics. Head to the boat ramp, you know. And basically, if you just took a hose to their wrist and their legs and slowly cooled them down and gradually dumped some over their head, it would probably take care of the issue. But if it's not you, you can't do that. Red snappers, American reds, they're hitting them offshore. Now, sardines are really one of the best baits out there for bottom fishing in the Gulf. The Spanish sardines or the East sardines, the ones that come from the Indian Ocean and all that, they're both great bait. I prefer the ones from South America because they're real shiny on the outside. Gorgeous looking bait, bright and shiny. But both of these sardines, and all sardines have it in common, they're soft, oily, mushy, nasty baits, which makes it everything a fish loves. But how do you keep it on the hook? A lot of times I'll use like a 7-aught hook. I'll go in through the eyes and then just stick it around back through the body, try and hold it all together. But the one thing I've always taken with me out in the Gulf is squid. I like squid for bait out in the Gulf. Now, if it's November through May, I'm going to have live shrimp with me because the shrimp migration starts about them, and then whatever the commercial fish shrimpers don't rape and pillage out of the harbor, and I say rape and pillage because they pull and they catch all this bait, and two-thirds, three-quarters of it, they dump back overboard because it's not big enough, it's not the right whatever it is. So when you're getting food shrimp from a commercial dragger boat, trawler, there's about 15 pounds of marine life has to die for that 1 pound of shrimp. You should not be able to do commercial food shrimping in Charlotte Harbor. It should be illegal. And there's a lot of it goes on. But because it happens in the middle of the night, usually in colder weather, nobody sees it. So, yeah, if you don't see it, it's not a problem. But back out to bottom fishing in the Gulf. I take squid and sardines, like I say, preferably the Spanish, but the Indian Ocean ones are fine. But trying to keep them on the hook is so challenging, people don't like it. So the best way to do this is I use about a, because we're using circle hooks here, I'm going up to about a 9-aught circle. I need the gap in there. And I prefer the Sure Set design, which is a modified version of a Kaylee hook, rather than the true circle hook. With the circle hook, it's actually round all the way on the bottom. And with the other one, it comes down, bends across, then points up, and you get a little bend back on the hook. It provides a wider gap. Now, I can go to about a 9-aught with that. Still have a relatively good-sized hook. Now, I'm speaking in VMC or Owner. If you get into the other brands, the hook sizes don't match up well. You got to kind of look at the VMC 9-aught, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Now, the Sure Set circle hooks. What I want to do is I lay the squid down, and when I'm using sardines, and I want to catch grouper with it, American Reds. Now, obviously, live pinfish, thread fins, small squirrel fish, all these are going to be the best bait when you can get them live, get them down there moving around. But you don't always get to do that. So, falling back to the sardines, what I'm doing is I take a squid and I lay it down, and then I start cutting it crossways. And what you end up with looks a lot like a rubber band. It's a round circle of squid because the inside of the squid is pretty hollow. When they're alive, the muscles and everything keep the body, the head, and the tentacles attached to the long tube part of the squid. But on that tube part, if you make slices, and they only want to be about a half an inch, and I put that over the sardine, like the rubber band going around it, and then I put the hook through the squid, through the sardine, back out through the squid, and that squid acts as a keeper and keeps that sardine on the hook. And we're still dealing with natural bait here, so yes, you have to use circle hook, but it's a really good way to get that sardine on the hook and drop it down. Now, I do have my best luck when I'm doing with sardines in the Gulf or shark fishing with them or snook fishing with them. I tend to hold the back of the sardine right before the tail, and then I like to literally break the tail off. And it usually comes right up out into the body of the sardine. So as it's missing that tail part, it really seems to let a lot of the smell go out. And as I put the hook in, I want to make sure that it goes through in the spot where it's going to release some of the scent from inside the entrails. Now, why would it be important to do the entrails and get that? If I've got this sardine hooked up and it's not really going to open the body of the fish up, I'll take a knife and poke a little hole in the belly. And the reason I do that is humans are pretty much the only creature on the planet that wants to eat the white meat. It is actually the least nutritious part, you know, the red meat, the muscle meat, the white meat of a fish. The meat is the least nutritious part of those animals. The entrails, the brain, all that, the liver, the, you know, all these, you know, gut parts, that's where all the vitamins are. And so by humans, we eat the white meat, but we can supplement with all kinds of other stuff. But liver used to be a big deal, eating your liver, you know, the cow's liver, whatever, chicken livers and all these other things. Because of the extra vitamins it carried, people were a lot healthier if they ate those parts. That's why I always want to make sure that scent comes out of whatever bait fish I have. If I have a dead thread fin, greenback, sardine, ladyfish, mullet, if I'm not cutting them into pieces and I'm using them as a whole bait, still always poke the belly, get that scent out, because the fish itself encapsulate all that smell inside of it. You don't think so. You think, oh no, the smell will get out. Just think, why does a fish float after a few days? The gases inside build up within the body and they don't come out because they're not in the place where he can just fart them out. You know, they're not just, you can't blow bubbles of that stuff. He's not alive. The intestinal system's not working. So can't blow bubbles that way. So it just builds up in the body. The fish floats up to the top. It's those smells we want to release. Let's go even to right now. Should you have live shrimp or dead shrimp? Well, if you're north of Cape Hayes, west side of the harbor, east side of the harbor, the reef, Port Charlotte canals, Punta Gorda canals, Eljabeen, dead shrimp is probably going to do as well, but I would actually say better than live shrimp. The reason being is the water's getting dark up here. We've had a lot of rain from Arcadia up to Orlando, and all that watershed, the water goes through the pastures, the fields, the little towns, the creeks, over the roads, into the ditches, into the pipes, into the creeks, into the river, and all that flows down on us. We get all of that right here. And as that water darkens up and becomes fresher and hotter, the fish are going to get less active. And as the water gets darker, their vision gets impaired. They can't see as far. If the water's crystal clear, they can see a bait fish 30, 40, 100 feet away. But if you put your hand underwater and you can't see it a foot underwater, that fish is only going to be able to see a foot or two in front of them. So what are they going to hunt by mostly? Smell and sound. So having the right smell, and let's face it, dead things have a much stronger odor than live things. Picture the room you're in right now. If you're very lucky, you don't smell the other people in your room. You know, you're sitting there and you've got people around you. You're in a restaurant. You're listening to us on the, you know, your phone with the headphones, and you're enjoying your cappuccino. But as you sniff around the room, you're not really detecting the other humans in the room. But now let's say one of those humans kicked the bucket. He's laying there and he's been there for a few hours. All of a sudden you start noticing that person's there in the room. It really gets to be like that. And it's the same thing with shrimp, fish, all these other things. But now, why would a fish be attracted to something? And believe it or not, if the shrimp's got a little bit of red orange on it where it's getting just a tiny bit rotten, or even your bait, if it's left out in the sun just a little bit, why would that be actually more enticing for an animal? Well, if you're over 40 years old, we used to have in this country the most amazing food in the world. We had grain-fed beef. and then you would hang it for a while, aged, right? Now, Joe, you know I'm right.
That's right.
Now, this new age grass-fed garbage beef is just so they can con you into believing that this is actually quality stuff. It's the cheapest garbage they can throw at us. And because they say grass-fed, what else would it be fed? Did you think they're eating broccoli? I mean, what are they doing, eating apples? I don't think so. Grass-fed is what herbivores eat. And humans used to understand how to make wonderful meals from this. They would bring them to the yard, feed them grains for about 3 months, get them all marbled up, and limit the amount of running around they could do. Where grass-fed beef, they bring them in off the pasture. They've been out running around. They're in better shape than the antelope, and the muscles are tough, and they got that stringy stuff in them. Well, that used to go away, and then they would take and age it for a couple weeks. In other words, let it decay. I mean, we don't want to call it that. We want to call it aging or hanging.
Yeah.
But the truth is, as it decayed a little bit, it became nicer food. It's a little more tender. It's a lot more pleasant. And pretty much a lot of animals on the planet. Leopards do it. Alligators do it. Even lions and all that. They'll eat on a fresh kill, but then they stash it away for a while. Let it tender up a little bit. Fish like that, too. They actually prefer a little bit of decay on their food. It's
aging.
That's what I was looking for. I wasn't trying to be so crude, but, you know, I'm sorry. I'm a pretty crude person, but very real. And if you're going to understand why you're using a bait, you kind of need a backstory for it. If I would just say, take a dead shrimp, throw it out there, yeah, you're going to catch more fish. You'd be like, yeah, well, you just don't have any live shrimp. That's why you want us to buy dead shrimp. And it's actually not true. There is no perfect bait. Shrimp are not the perfect bait. White bait is not the perfect bait. Ladyfish is not. Crabs are not. What you want to correctly say is, it's the perfect bait for right now. With the weather conditions, the water conditions, this would be the best bait to use. And it's usually an option of one or two. But once the water is over 85 degrees, and our water is definitely over 85 degrees, it's lacking oxygen, and fish cannot use their sight. They have a hard time hunting visually. So they switch over to use the smelling it, listening for food or smelling for food. And if the food is a little more pungent, you're going to catch more fish. They can smell it from farther away. So believe it or not, the fresher, nicer the meat is, it works really well, but sometimes a little aging on it can actually bring fish in from further away. But this is the time of year to start doing what we call dead sticking. And dead stick really means the fishing pole should act like it's dead. It doesn't move at all. So you want to throw, take a blue crab. Now what we do with the blue crabs, if they're fresh, not frozen, you hold the legs and on one of the points on each side, you get very sharp, long points on each side, begin to lift that away from the legs. Now you all heard of soft shell crabs because crabs molt. And once a month or so, they actually step out of their old body, the hard shell, come out, they're soft, they get bigger, they expand out, get hard again, and quite often go back and eat their own shell. It's a lot of nutrients in that shell, and they just got rid of those, they could use them back. But it's that molting process. When you take, you're looking at a crab, and you hold it up in front of you, looking them face to face, the top shell and the bottom shell are not very well connected. It would appear to be, but they're actually not. So when you hold the legs and lift that point up, it will actually separate in half. Now, inside there, you're going to see all the guts and gills and heart and meat in that crab. And it's, weirdly enough, the meat is kind of like four chunks of it. I don't know, you got a thing of meat here, another thing of meat next to it, then a cross meat, and it like four squares of meat. So usually if it's a smaller crab, I'll break it in half. If it's a bigger one, we break it into quarters. Now, you can use a knife or just snap it with your hands. But you put that crab meat on and pick a spot to throw it. Throw it out there, set the rod in the rod holder, and don't touch it. The biggest mistake people make is checking their bait, especially when they're using crabs. Because as you bring it back to the boat, you've washed almost all the meat off of it. You've definitely washed everything else off it. There might be a little bit of meat there, but pretty much everything else is gone. And then when you throw it back out, the fish has to find it all over again. So when I'm tossing out a chunk of dead crab, what I'm doing is throwing it out there, set the rod in the rod holder, and it's going to be in there for 40 minutes. At least 40 to 45 minutes. I'm not going to touch that rod. Because if I do, I move it 3 or 4 feet or 2 feet, the fish have got to find it again. And if the water's murky, that's a lot of searching and hunting around. It might lose interest. They might not be that hungry. So 40 to 45 minutes when you toss a chunk of crab out. And it's not a bad idea to practice casting a little bit. Can't tell you how many times I get out on the water and I don't have many crabs. They're expensive. And I want to get that bait right where I want it. My first cast, and it goes 15 feet away from the trees. I got to reel it back in. I lost all the good stuff that was on that bait from bringing it back up to the boat. Try to recast it. So what I do quite a bit is I actually make a couple practice casts. Put a lure on that's about the same weight as the crab. I'm not usually, unless I have a lot of current, I don't need a sinker on this. But let's say we got a little bit of current. Now, if I've got current enough where I need a weight on there, crab would probably be my second choice. I'm going to take a chunk of ladyfish or a piece of mullet first. It's harder to wash it clean. It keeps its smell longer. With the crab, it washes off so quick, it's a hard time for fish to find it. They're following the smell down current from it. When you've got a very light tide movement, which is best for fishing chunks of dead crab, they don't get washed off as fast. But throwing it out there and not having it go where you want it, you really just kind of wasted that piece of bait. So put something on similar, make a couple of nice casts up by the mangroves. Now, why am I throwing this chunk of crab that close to the mangroves? And I mean, in a perfect world, I'm at the drip edge of the mangrove branches or under. If you're 3 or 4 feet out, you might as well throw it on the other side of the boat. You got to be closer than that. It's called damn it fishing, where, damn, that's a good cast, or damn it, I'm in the trees. So you want to practice this, but if you snag the trees, you're going to look for another spot, because just jerking your lure hook, whatever it is, out of the mangroves will quite often scare the fish out. Why would the rustling of the branches scare the fish? Think raccoons, they eat fish, bobcats, all these animals that would be jumping down on top of a fish to make a meal out of them. Life is not a Disney movie. If it's smaller than you, you try to eat it. If it's bigger than you, you run from it. That's life on the planet, you know. Unless humans are feeding the creatures, and then they tend to get along really good because they don't care about the food. But when there's no humans around and they're hungry, they don't get along that well. But just trying to give you an idea, different times of year call for different types of baits. Snook and redfish both like to eat dead bait. And that's why I was talking about the crabs. People don't associate blue crabs with snook. Snook love eating blue crabs. They love the spider crabs on the branches. Snook love eating crabs, especially when they're broken into pieces. Breaking into pieces? Broken into pieces. Okay. English is a good second language for me. First language, obviously, is illiterate redneck. But we're going to go back with snook and English. I've caught so many snook in that 40-inch range on chunks of blue crabs, people would be just shocked. And if you can find a place where one of the local crabbers loads his boat on the trailer. And usually once they get back, they get the boat on the trailer. They spend a little while culling out whatever's got mixed up in the box they don't really want, stuff that's too small, females they might not have noticed. And they're trying to get them back in the water. Well, snooks soon learn where they're doing this. And they will stack up around those boat ramps because that's just free food. And so you go up there with a little crab, you put it on the hook, toss it out there, boom, 40-inch snook. People say, well, there's no big snook around anymore. It's not true. There's a lot of big snook, probably more than ever. But people forgot how to fish for them. They have no idea what a Calcutta pole is. They don't understand that white bait is the best small, medium-sized snook bait, but it's not a big snook bait because the little ones get to it first. But you toss a 14, 16-inch whole ladyfish out there, same thing on a mullet. The whole thing, just I poke a little hole in the guts, I leave it intact, put a hook right through the lower lip, out between the eyes, get a big hook there, sling it out within 3 to 4, usually about 3 feet of the seawall or the edge of the bank. I'm looking for not more than 4 feet of water, but I want to be very close to land with it. 2 to 3 feet of water's best. And then you just sit back and wait. Now, quite often, we've got 4, 5, 6, 8 ounces of lead on that. Putting a big sinker on, drop it out there, and just you're waiting for that big fish. This is how you catch big snook. Now, you can do the same thing around any shrimp boat or anywhere else because as they're culling their catch, they're throwing it overboard into the water and fillet tables. If you watch people where they're filleting fish, these monster snook just stack up around the fillet tables because while you're not supposed to throw anything in the water, I don't get why it's a problem. You know, it's feeding the creatures that are right there. And they learn that to come and eat them. But you watch somebody, you know, throw just the skin of a fish off the side after he's flayed the meat off. And boosh, big old fish comes and knocks it apart. You ever watch that, Joe?
Yeah. You're feeding them. You know, it's
constant food, easy to get.
And where else would you fish for fish? Where there's food. If there's no food, they don't want to be there.
And right now, we've had a lot of rain, and Joe and I were talking right before the show. You know, they're calling for rain every day here, which is very, very possible. But it's 50-50. It could rain on your neighbor's house and not your house, or rain on your house and not your neighbor's house. That's Florida. But what it does do, and this is what people don't really get, the rain that falls on Englewood, Port Charlotte, Punta Gorda, Elgin, places like that, really doesn't affect the harbor that much. But when it happens up the Myakka River, up the Peace River, that's what affects the lower harbor. Rains over Okeechobee affects the lower harbor. Because the Coosahatchee is all the way at the bottom of Charlotte Harbor. It's almost 20 miles from us up here in the north end of Charlotte Harbor. It has very little effect on what goes on in Charlotte Harbor. But the Peace River and Myakka River have a huge effect because they're right at the top of the harbor. They're at the headwaters. They are the headwaters. So as all that fresh water starts coming down, people tend to think that the water gets diluted down. And the really weird part about it is, as that water's coming down the river, it hits the salt water kind of like the salt water is a pile of dirt and the fresh water is like a bulldozer. And as it bumps up against it, the bulldozer rises up or the fresh water goes up and runs along the top. And it can take weeks, literally weeks, for the harbor at the water in the bottom of the harbor to actually start becoming fresh or less salty. Starts out with the first few inches becoming fresh, then you get a foot or two. Right now, it would be very possible to see gars, freshwater alligator gar, all the way down by Cape Hayes. Now, if that gar dives down 3 feet, that salt's going to start burning his gills. Saltwater fish can go into freshwater very easily. It doesn't really bother them. As long as there's a decent mineral count in it, they can actually live pretty good in it. But a freshwater fish going into saltwater, the problem they have is the salt starts to burn their gills out. But because freshwater floats on top of saltwater, and the gar lives, they pretty much spend most of their life within a few inches of the surface. Maybe going down to 2 or 3 feet, but they like that first 1 to 2 feet of water, sometimes just a matter of an inch or two below the surface. And so they go all over the harbor. Now, what's unusual is guy came into the store and he's saying, well, you know, I know that, you know, I've read on your website because I have all these arrows pictures and, you know, 24 color glossy pictures with circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one explaining what it is and how it will be used as evidence against you. But he said, the water's still brown up by the islands. And I said, well, you got Boca Grande Pass, Gasparilla Pass. That's where the upper harbor gets most of its water. Below that, you have Captiva, Redfish, and Ponarasa. They're all sending water into that lower part of the harbor. And what it is most of the water from Boca continues east until it hits the east side. Very little of it goes south. Some does, but not very much. 80% of it's going to go all the way over towards Burnt Store, hits that east side of the harbor, travels north. If the tide is long enough, it deflects off of Punta Gorda, which means wide point. And you understand that if you see a map, Punta Gorda is this big wide point that sticks out of there. And it ends up over in the Mayaca River. But the problem is when we're getting a lot of rain, all of the runoff from that area from Burnt Store Road all the way down to the harbor, all the fields are collecting water, and it's slowly moving into little depressions and forms creeks, and those creeks are running into the harbor, constantly supplying more brown water. So it's impossible to get rid of all of the brown water with a good incoming tide on the east side. But it does clear out the main part of the flats. And then as the tide goes out, sucks more water out of the creeks, pulls more water from up on the rivers, and the water gets brown again. It's clearer on the incoming, darker on the outgoing. But it's kind of neat how it all plays out together. And we will here sometime in the next month or so, Charlotte Harbor will be predominantly fresh water if we get enough rain. And the neat thing about that is, yeah, the water gets all brown and nasty and everything else, but fresh water tends to kill bacteria and everything else that live in salt water. And then as the rains subside and the cooler water comes in and we don't have all that, the salt water, Charlotte Harbor, becomes all salt water. And salt water tends to kill bacteria or whatever else is in the water, all that smaller stuff, that if it lives in fresh water, salt water would tend to kill it. Now, right now, because of my diabetes and my smoking and all that, I've got bad circulation in my legs, and so I have a couple open sores. I will not get in salt water right now. Not going to happen. Because the salt water near the surface is in the 90-some degree range. Shallow water, you know, where you would be swimming. So if you've got open sores, ocean water or Gulf of Mexico water and your blood have almost the exact same salinity level. That's why they think we came from the oceans, is because human blood and salt water are almost identical. And now we're going to put them at almost the exact same temperature. Now, if you go swimming down here and the Gulf is less than 80 degrees, even if it's got bacteria or whatever else in it, if it hits your 98 degree body temperature, even though the salinity level is the same and it can easily live in either or, it goes into shock and dies. That allows your body to fight off all these things. But when the water temperature and your blood are within just a couple of degrees, none of that bacteria or whatever else it might be goes into shock. It just easily goes right into your blood system. That's why really warm, hot saltwater bacteria are so easily transferred. You ever notice you hear about all these people getting sick or that or whatever? It's always in the summer, late fall. It's almost never in December or January, early spring. And it's because it matches up too close. It's why you have more instances of things like that in saltwater than you do in freshwater. Because once again, if it's surviving in a freshwater lake, it has a hard time coming into your bloodstream because it's saltwater. Little weird facts. I don't know if they're relevant or not, but
I thought it was very interesting.
It's one of those things that if you understand what's going on, you don't just assume it's always bad or always good. Things can be different. And it's the hardest thing in our culture and our society today is things don't have to be good or bad. They can simply be different. One has better qualities while doing this and other better qualities while doing that. It's not a good and evil, bad or good world. There's a lot in the middle of all this. And, you know, the Gulf of Mexico is a great place to swim and have fun and enjoy yourself. But I'm older. I got a lot of problems with me. So I'm going to wait and I'll go out there when the water cools down. It's safer for me and, you know, quite honestly, it's more refreshing when you get in the water and it actually feels cool. But if you put your foot in the water and it feels warm, you might want to think about going later.
Yeah.
But
what about the people from up north that come down? Just think how they feel.
Yeah, I would assume that's a lot of our audience. You know what I mean? And the funniest part about it is May and June are the best months to come to Florida to find fishing. You have the least weather problems. You've got the most big fish. It's really funny. We get the most northern visitors in November, December, January, when we quite literally have the smallest fish of the year. Excluding snook, any redfish that was big enough to go with the school has left the harbor. And that all happens October, November, that September, October, November are the spawning months for redfish. Redfish, as they become adults, leave Charlotte Harbor. They could end up in Massachusetts, Texas. They go everywhere. They got basically 3-4 months to swim all day long one direction. Then they turn around and swim 3 or 4 months to come back. Boy meets girl. They have their babies. And every year when they come back into the harbor or wherever else the school would spawn, they come in and there's young redfish. As they're big enough, they join up with those adults and leave the harbor. That's why it's so weird for me with the way they do the redfish laws. It's like, it's stupid. You know, understand how the fish live, where they go, what they do, and you can make better laws. But I don't know. To me, it's as simple as when snook's in season, redfish should be out. When redfish is in, snook should be out. And just let them change, you know, go every 3 months. You can catch this one, and you can't catch that one. Then you can catch that one, not this one. Pretty simple. But anyway, with the redfish, November, December, January is when we have our smallest redfish, because any redfish that was big enough to leave with adults, they're gone. Now, as the year progresses, redfish will grow anywhere from 1/2 inch to 1 inch a year. And so they keep getting bigger, which brings us back to peewee shrimp season. And peewee shrimp season, we've talked about a little bit on the shows, but every year around November, December, January, all the snook start shrimp start migrating out of the harbor, not the snook, the shrimp. And as they leave, you can't get live shrimp from more than 15 feet of water. You pull the net up, the shrimp are all dead. You might be able to get up to 20, but pretty doubtful. Under 10 is the best. Best liveliest shrimp, least dead loss. But the adults are gone. The big ones are gone. And what's weird is you always have a few that just don't want to leave with everybody else. It's like during Hurricane Charlie, the government said, you got to go here to that building. I went the other way. You know, I'm that straggler big shrimp because I'm not listening to the pack. I don't go that way. I always figure if the government tells me you're going to be safe if you go to the left, I'm heading to the right as fast as I can. I don't know why I don't believe anything they say. Let's see. Experience and knowledge. I guess I would call that into play. So anyway, as we go through the summer, the shrimp that we're getting the majority of right now are the ones that were hatched last fall. And as they grow up, and by this August, September, they'll actually be a lot nicer size. And they're the brothers, cousins, sisters of the ones we're using now. And even though I make my money selling bait, it would not bother me. And I would take the loss of income if they would simply put, and the reason Florida doesn't do it is they're cheap. Because this will require somebody from the state to go out once a week and sample the sizes of shrimp out there and make sure that the shrimp are large enough to have spawned at least once. If they got rid of all the food shrimping, if you live on Charlotte Harbor, you should be able to go out and commercially catch food shrimp there. But if you don't live there, you live somewhere else, you should not be allowed to drag a net in Charlotte Harbor or any of the other bays and inlets. Do it out in the Gulf. That's what the Gulf is for. But if we simply did stuff, we would have a lot more shrimp. If we just let them spawn once and as adults go to the Gulf and maintain that good spawn, that's what Texas did. That's what Louisiana did. I believe Mississippi. And that's the reason all those boats are here during those winter months is because shrimping's closed in these other states. So why they allow them to do it here, I don't know. I would say lazy. The state does not want to pay for somebody to go out and sample to make sure the shrimp, okay, and this should be for bait shrimp or food shrimp. Once they hit a certain size, they sample it and they say, okay, they've spawned. All right, guys, go out and do your thing. That way we'd always maintain a certain level. We'd have a lot more fish because with fish, they're even simpler than I am, and that's saying something. I mean, I'm one of the simplest creatures on the planet. I like it, I don't like it. Pfft, who cares? Okay, but with shrimp, fish, the more you feed them, the faster they grow. The more babies they have, the more everything happens. The less food they have, the slower they grow. It's actually very hard to starve a fish. It's very hard to starve a shrimp. They just don't grow much. They slow down, their metabolism goes slower, and then they eat and it goes back up. It's so the more food they have, the more fish you have, you know, the faster it's all growing, the more better everything would be.
In other words, let nature be the judge of what's going on.
Well, basically, the problem with eco-idiots, and this is most of our scientific community, A, it's agenda science. They need a paycheck. This is not their fault. This is the way the government is set up. If you go to the government, the U.S. government, state governments, whatever, and you say, you know what? The shrimp are doing just fine. Boy, things are good. You know, let's keep an eye on it, but everything looks really good. So they get your paperwork, and they look and go, oh, everything's good. Okay, you're out of a job. You go home. We're not going to pay you anymore. Everything's good. We don't need you. So if that same scientist goes to the government and goes, the shrimp are in really big trouble. We're going to lose our whole shrimp population if we don't do something. We're going to need to study this. We're going to need to, we're going to need a lot more money. We're going to have to be out there every day checking on this, checking our all this stuff. And we've got to get up on this problem. And the government says, oh my God, we've got problems. How much more money do you need? And that's the way that science works in this country. And it's not really the scientists' fault. I think a lot of them would like to be truthful. And whether it's about fish or crustaceans, the weather, the climate, they got to get paid. They went to college. They got student loans to pay off. If someone's willing to pay them, they're going to say anything that that person wants to hear. And we wish it wasn't that way, but it kind of is. But getting back into the fishing, if we had sampling done where we could farm our environment, eco-idiots want it. Let nature alone. Let it do its own thing. That's ridiculous. We took 90% of nature away. We left this little patch here and said, okay, here you go. Do your thing right here. Now, if you go to the Everglades and you go, they got some awesome airboat places down there. And I've gone down and paid for the airboat rides. If you haven't done it, go down and do it. They got some great airboat rides. And you're going to get there and you're going to see around the marina there where they keep it dredged out and everything's nice. You see gazillions of fish. You see all this wildlife, and there's birds and there's everything. It's amazing. And then you get out and you go where the people aren't allowed to touch anything. Dead zone. Gators that were down there, I mean, at least now they can eat pythons. Because before, the gators were literally eating snails to try and stay alive.
Wow.
Without people to take care of the environment, we need to farm our environment. We need to maintain creek depths. We need to, you know, if you look at a farm, is there a shortage of animals? No. Go around town and look, and you're going to see flocks of ibis and, I mean, picture a bird, a herring, storks. There is birds everywhere. I challenge you to go in the middle of any national forest and see 1% of the birds you see in any subdivision. Any Harbor Heights, Northport. Look around. There's birds on all the lawns. They're in the trees. You got wildcats. You got possums. You got skunks. You got everything.
Yep.
They all live with us because it's nicer.
Sandhill cranes all over the place.
You don't see those in the middle of the woods in the forest. You go out there and all you see is bugs and ticks and, you know, every nasty creature on the planet. But have humans move in, clean it all up, make it a little nicer, fix it up, clean out the water supplies. And what do you got? Gazillions of animals. We should be farming our resources. As what I mean by that is taking care of them the same way a farmer takes care of his property. Make sure the water's clean. Make sure everything's taken care of. And we'd have a gazillion more fish and a gazillion more animals. I hate to say it, but it's literally that simple. You know, gag grouper. This is the time of year, and I'm going to sneak this in on the end to see who has stayed listening. Usually you're figuring you're going out to 80, 100 plus feet of water to find gag grouper, and they are open. Truth is, they're spawning in the harbor right now. There are legal gag grouper in the harbor, in the passes. It's going on right now. This is the forgotten thing. This is one of the reasons you should listen to the show is, A, I'm an over-opinionated, arrogant, egotistical weirdo, but I happen to tell what I believe is the truth, and I want you guys to have fun and catch fish. There are gag grouper in the harbor. And there's a lot of Goliath grouper in the harbor. The way you tell the difference is a gag grouper has a rounded tail. A Goliath grouper has a concaved tail. It's doesn't go down in a straight line. Gag grouper tail is from a straight line to a little bit. The centers actually stick. The top and bottom stick out further than the center. With a Goliath grouper, the center of the tail sticks out farther than the top and the bottom. So if it's got a rounded paddle tail, can't keep it. But the other ones you can, and they're in the harbor right now. If you want to troll the 20-foot hole, the middle hole, Pirate Harbor hole, look for a Rapala 10 or a 12 or a 14. Now the 10, you're going to let out a little extra line because you actually want to get down to, well, 15, 16 feet. The problem with trolling a 14 or a 15 diving Rapala is that what happens is you're going from 18, 20 feet of water up to 12, 14. So as you see, watch your rod. If all of a sudden you see the rod tip kind of bouncing and jerking a little bit, means your lure's tapping the bottom. Bring it up a crank and go along until it does it. Now, if it swims too free for a while, you want to be able to let some line out. Here's the thing. If you're trolling with spinning reels, it's easy on the conventionals. The drag's easier to work with. But I do the same thing on the spinning reels. I just tighten the lure up until it stops going out away from the boat. No more than that. If I've got a conventional, I'm doing the same thing. With a conventional, when I see the rod hit and the fish blow, stick my thumbs on the spool, set the hook, and let go. With a spinning rod, I simply cup the spool, set the hook, and let go of the spool. Now I can adjust my drags and land the fish. That's your tip for the day. But from Boca Grande Pass all the way up to the reef, you got Gag Grouper in the harbor, boys and girls. It's not on the fishing report. Are we out of time, Joe?
We got another minute or so.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, I was just looking at the clock up there. I never know which. Sometimes we stop at 5:02. Sometimes it's 4:02. I'm never sure. But go to fishandfranks.com, click the fishing report, and you see a place-by-place breakdown of it. Now, if you're driving, I don't want you reading the report. So go to the radio fishing part and click that week's fishing report. And understand, if you're only interested in some of it, it follows the written report exactly, because that's how they're writing it down. So whether you're listening to it on Radio Fishing or reading it on the fishing report, fishandfranks.com. Northerners go fishing with a G. Southerners go fishing without
fishing.
It.
Fishing, that's it.
Anyway, Fish and Frank here. Joe, our synthetic android humanoid control person. RJ will be back one day when he's released from the cybernetic hold.
I did the best I could, folks.
Did great, Joe.